This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We're back in our studios in New York City. Much to think about, much to get to on this busy Monday. First, the ramifications from the events in Boston last week. Dzhokhar Tsarnaev and his late brother have roots in Chechnya. And as people who knew the young boys have been speaking, some reports suggest the two were trying to find out more about the troubled history of Chechnya during their own lifetimes. Should there be a presumption of suspicion of people from troubled regions of the world whose anger may not be contained by normal-looking behavior? Should defendants arrested for crimes of terrorism be presumed to be part of a terrorist movement in some sense and a danger to all Americans? Two views of the Tsarnaev brothers now. We'll look at the criteria prosecutors may be using to evaluate Dzhokhar in police custody in that Boston hospital. But first, is there a question about where the loyalties of people from places like Chechnya lie when they come to America? Joining us now is former Pakistani ambassador to the UK, Akbar Ahmed, who's chairman of Islamic Studies at American University in Washington, author of The Thistle and the Drone, How America's War on Terrorism Became a War on Tribal Islam. Welcome, Ambassador.
Nice to be back again.
I want to get directly into this quote in The New York Times, where you spoke to reporter Scott Shane and said that these individuals are American, but not quite American, referring to Dzhokhar Tsarnaev and his brother Tamerlan.
Yes, I was trying to capture this sense of immigrants who haven't completely absorbed themselves into American life and culture and haven't quite given up their previous life, their previous culture, as it were, as being suspended, neither quite of the old nor quite of the new. And that is dangerous territory for any individual to be in. We see the same phenomena in some of the other cases of the homegrown terrorists, young men disaffected, alienated, their own communities not able to completely absorb them or guide them, the religious leaders, the imams, the social leaders, the Muslim leaders, in a sense, failing them. And then larger society itself here in the United States, the schooling system, the media, which is very often seen as hostile to Muslims, all of these tend to push away the individual. And if that individual is asking questions, is disturbed, is inclined to listen to those who do not like the United States, we have a very dangerous, combustible mixture.
Now, the transition you've described could be common to virtually all immigrants in that you've not completely left your old culture behind and not fully embraced the new culture in the United States. But what is it about Chechen history that might be particularly inflammatory to these young men?
That's a very interesting question. You're absolutely right. There are hundreds and thousands of Muslims who've come here, and they've adjusted perfectly all right. In a generation or two, all their differences have faded away, and they're American. In these two, we see something a bit more different, and that is the tribal background, the ethnic background. They're coming from Chechnya. That is a land that has been ravaged over the last few decades by the late 1990s, when these two are young boys, young men, and they're coming out of that society. Something like 10% of the entire population is wiped out, killed. Their families have been thrown into Kyrgyzstan, then they come back to Dagestan, and from there they migrate to the United States. So they're coming from a background of ravage and rape and mutilation and torture, and they have that in their minds. The code of honor, which dominates their lives, also demands revenge. It features hospitality, courage, honor, but it also features revenge. And in a mutated, distorted interpretation of that code, I can imagine them just going crazy and being completely nihilistic and really biting the hand that fed them, which is the United States.
But as we learn more about these individuals, can you foresee an argument, and it appears that they were granted political asylum in the United States, and the United States has been very critical of the Putin government's approach to Chechnya and precisely the human rights violations that you cite here. Can you envision an argument on Capitol Hill that would go something like this? We can't grant political asylum to people from Chechnya because they're so ravaged by their history that they're more inclined to become radicalized in the United States.
This is a very relevant point. I've discussed this at length, not only for the Chechens, but also for 40 other tribal societies across the Muslim world in my new book, The Thistle and the Drone, in which I've said exactly this. For many of these tribal societies, the United States is a beacon. It's, in fact, in a painting, in a Somali painting It was depicted as the tree of life, a benefactor. And yet, it's these very people, some of them, we must be very clear here, not all of them, very marginal, a couple of them, do in fact turn up loathing and hating and attacking the United States. And that needs to be studied. I believe this is a line of inquiry that has not been explored. And here you really need an understanding of culture, of history, of what is motivating these individuals and what is causing them to behave like this. It's a failure. It's a failure of their own community, their leadership. And in a sense, it's a failure of larger society not to be able to anticipate these trends and allow these horrific incidents to take place, causing so much death and destruction.
We're talking with Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, who's chairman of Islamic Studies at American University in Washington. I'm wondering, are you concerned at all that while these are worthy subjects of discussion, and yes, indeed, these communities do need to be studied, but you are inadvertently offering fuel to people like Congressman Peter King on Long Island, who really wants, as a matter of course, all Muslims to be studied with a presumption that they have a divided loyalty and can all turn against the United States on some level?
Now, that, of course, is blatantly absurd because you have Muslims living here like the congressmen, African-Americans, Muhammad Ali, the great icon, the boxing champ, and so on. And Muslims have lived here for centuries. They're as American as any other community. So on the face of it, that's absurd. At the same time, regardless of what Peter King or people like that say in the media and privately or publicly, I would want, as someone very committed to interfaith dialogue, intercultural dialogue, bridge building, to actually have serious studies which allow us to understand this problem and therefore tackle it. I'm concerned, I'm distressed that this sort of incident is happening again and again and again. This is not the first time. And I am very apprehensive that it won't be the last time. Now, in order to prevent it happening again, we need proper studies, not emotion, not prejudice, and certainly not ignorance.
Akbar Ahmed is chairman of Islamic Studies at American University in Washington, author of The Thistle and the Drone, How America's War on Terrorism Became a War on Tribal Islam. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Joining us now to talk about some of the legal implications of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev's custody in Boston and his awaiting the legal system to deal with him, Stephen Vladeck joins us, a professor of law and associate dean for scholarship at American University Washington College of Law. Professor, welcome.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
What could be the possible considerations determining whether he's an enemy combatant, the kinds of questions of rights reading, that sort of thing, and how this trial would proceed? What are the criteria that prosecutors and others in the justice system will be using?
Well, I think there's no real question on the enemy combatant issue. I mean, to date, we have no information suggesting that he has any affiliation with al-Qaeda or any of the other groups that Congress has authorized the use of military force against. So this really is just a question of our ordinary civilian criminal justice system. And there, I think the biggest question for prosecutors is at what point the law enforcement officers should stop interrogating him and advise him of his Miranda rights, allow him to meet with counsel, etc. I mean, with regard to interrogations, the issue only arises if and when the prosecution tries to introduce what Tsarnaev would say in those interrogations at trial. You know, given how much physical evidence we suspect the government already has against him, I think it's unlikely that anything he might say in a future interrogation is actually going to matter at trial. And so long as the government doesn't rely on his statements, really, this is not going to be a question.
But does that mean they have a free hand in interrogations because they've got the goods on him from everything that happened last week?
Well, I think, you know, free hand is a tricky idea. I mean, I think it's not quite a free hand. Obviously, they can't, you know, torture him. They can't use methods that are themselves illegal. But with regard to advising him of his right to remain silent, with regard to advising him of his right to a lawyer, you know, I think the government, if they want to, can take the chance that they wouldn't be able to use anything he says at trial, given how much physical evidence they have against him. And so Tsarnaev wouldn't really be advised of his rights until the point at which he's presented before a judge, which is supposed to be 48 hours from when, you know, he's able to communicate.
Remind us of how the dance card is organized here. Who's the lead prosecutor? Is this a federal case first, a local case first? What's the interaction of prosecutors in Massachusetts, in Boston, and then at the federal level?
Sure. I mean, by all accounts, this is going to be a case where the federal government asserts not just primary but exclusive authority. And so I think this is going to be the FBI and the Justice Department show through and through. The mentality that the federal government has, and that's reflected in various statutes that Congress has passed, is that these kinds of terrorism-based crimes, regardless of affiliation to international organizations or not, really are such a national issue. And raise such national concerns that actually the federal government shouldn't just have concurrent jurisdiction, you know, the joint power to prosecute with states, but that in some cases they should be the only authority to prosecute because terrorism is unique, because the federal government has special expertise when it comes to these cases, and because, to be frank, you know, the federal prosecutors in Boston are just as local as the local prosecutors are.
Let me take a slightly cynical track here, and you can correct me if I veer into the weeds here on some level, but you described the mentality of the federal government regarding these kinds of cases. Given all due consideration to the safety of Americans and to the people of Boston after what happened last week, is it difficult to sort out what that's going on in the court is related specifically to protecting, safety of civilians and seeking justice, and what might be construed as something of a show trial, an attempt to really sort of capitalize on the focus of all of Americans on this particular case?
I mean, I think that's always a concern, John, when you have such a high-profile terrorism prosecution. And I think the only way to mitigate that concern is for the trial judge, you know, to really sort of keep control over the case, to make this a case really about the specific acts that Tsarnaev is charged with perpetrating, and not about sort of the more general emotional response that those acts provoked. And, you know, that's a difficult line to split, but I think it's one that we ask judges to split every day, and it's one that most judges, I think, are fairly good at. The place where I think it gets really tricky is if we actually do get to a point where the government is trying to use, you know, things Tsarnaev might yet say in an interrogation against him. You know, I suspect the government will rely on this idea of a public safety exception to Miranda. And then the question becomes, where is the line between law enforcement officers asking a suspect questions that are about protecting the public from future harm and the line between trying to get the suspect to implicate himself? And I think that's actually the harder place here, and that's the harder line for judges to draw when it comes to sort of focusing on what this guy actually did versus focusing on the, you know, if you will, the bloodlust of popular sentiment.
Well, something to think about there, and a judge will certainly be thinking about it this week. Stephen Vladeck, professor of law and associate dean for scholarship at American University Washington College of Law. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
So what do you think? Justice for Tsarnaev or show trial? Jim writes on Facebook, no need to drag a motion into this debate. He's an American citizen and a suspected criminal. Either all Americans deserve the same rights or no American deserves those rights. Coming up, a senior diplomat and a veteran lawmaker on United States policy toward Iran. The big stick isn't working. That's coming up here on The Takeaway.